Testing, 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 testing.
Machine like that and taking everything. They got it up the library.
I'm going to say a few words. This is a very beautiful sunny afternoon. We've been up at Sam's Point and we're sitting on a terrace at the home of Mr. John Miller. And I believe that he's just celebrated his 90th birthday. Is that right? How old are you?
Of course, this is smaller, but the average boat on the canal is 94 feet long and about 13 and a half feet wide. That's the size of the canal boat. Of course, this is only a miniature to what the canal boat is. Then we have a place here. Now here's like the cabin of the boat, and here's the rudder and the tiller for to steer the boat. And here's what they call the bow stem, the bow deck, and this is a stern deck, and this is a cabin, and this is a feed box where we keep our feed in for to feed the mules and horses. And down in the hole here is where we put the coal and carry it. Now the regular boat weighs 35 ton when it's light, has nothing in. And when it goes to Honesdale, Pennsylvania, and it gets loaded, then we load it up, and they put about 135 to 40 ton of coal on this boat. And then that goes down to the end of the canal towards Kingston, and there they weigh it to find out how much coal there is on the boat. And we, the captain of a boat, run one of these boats. We got 70 cents a ton, what the canal company paid us for carrying coal from down from Honesdale to Kingston. Now, I don't know what more.
Well, I'll tell you, I'd like to go back, since it's your 90th birthday, back to... say your father, was he a canaller?
My father was a canaller.
And was your grandfather a canaller?
No, my grandfather wasn't a canaller. He always lived here.
Do you remember your father telling you any stories about the early days of the canal?
Well, no, I do not. No, of course, not anything more than pictures. That, of course, the canal, when it first started, they were smaller boats. Maybe I got a chair in the wood house.
No, we prefer.
And, of course, I don't know. When? They were smaller boats when they started this canal, carried 75 ton of coal. Then they enlarged the canal. That's a good many years ago. I don't know how long ago that is.
Well, when your father was canaling and you were a little boy, did you drive the mules?
I used to drive the mules. I was go up and down the canal, walking on the towpath, barefooted. I was only 8 years old. Huh. And I got tired of walking. I'd jump on the mule's back, get on and ride.
Did you enjoy it, or did you feel...
Oh, I enjoyed it. Us kids, you know, we just like that, and when we wanted to take a swim, we jumped in the canal.
Did you have brothers and sisters who did it too?
Oh, well, there was only, I had five brothers that boated on the canal. Some boated with me and some boated with my father. I had a boat of my own, and I had my brother with me, and my father, he run a boat, and he had one of the boys, two of the boys with him. Mm-hmm. That's the way we boated on the canal.
When you were young and you were a boy boating, did you ever have any trouble with the other boys on the canal? They're teasing you or anything like that?
Oh, we used to get in fights. That don't make any difference, you know. We We was hardened into it. We didn't worry about anything like that. If we got in a squabble, why, we'd get out of it.
Uh-huh.
That was all there was to that. And we'd go along. I know I was a kid one time up this side of Lackawaxen. That's up the side of, over the Delaware River. And my father bought me a new pair of shoes in Honesdale. And when I got down there, there was a nice apple tree over the fence off of the towpath. So I goes over and I take my shoes off to go up the apple tree to get apples. We were stealing them. So when I went down, that had come that night, towards evening, I wanted to get my shoes to put them on. I says to my father, how about my shoes? He says, where are they? Oh, I says, I left them up there by that apple tree. Then we was about 15 miles away from there. I said, no more of the shoes. I left my new pair of shoes there.
Well, we can understand that from people leaving things today up on Sam's Point and so on. We heard about the canalers and the raftsmen. Do you remember seeing any of the rafts?
Oh, yeah. They come down the Delaware River. That's where the rafters come. They come from up in Pennsylvania, up that way, and they come down and up to the Delaware. There was an aqueduct where the canal used to go over the river.
Uh-huh.
See? And then there was a big dam right under that, right below that aqueduct. And these rafts would come down. There's always two men on these rafts. And they had, like a rudder. They had a big paddle on, big long sticks, and they used to run back and forth across these logs to steer it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd come down and go over this dam, and then they'd go over. When they went over that dam, some of them, part of it would be underwater, and that's just the way they would come down them logs. They went right on down to Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And down the Delaware River.
Did you ever hear of any trouble between the canalers and the raftsmen?
Oh, no. They was altogether a different line.
Uh-huh. They never got into any fights with each other.
Oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the river was down below and the canal was up above.
I see.
See, they didn't get in contact with any.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then at night, you all slept in the little cabin?
In this boat here, or a canal boat, none of this deck here, the stern deck, there was two bunks. We called them, there was our beds, but we called them bunks. There was like a double bunk big enough for two people to get into a bed. And then there was a side bunk under this cabin here, like on up against the side of the boat, where a single bed where one could lay into that and sleep. That's the way we, and of course we had a table in this cabin here. This cabin was about 10 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
See, the boat here.
About 10 feet long, about how wide?
Well, the boat was 13 and a half feet wide. Of course, that extension along in here, along up to the side of the boat, there was a place where they had closets in, where they kept all their eatables and all the things in.
Mm-hmm.
And then on this side, on one side, there they had their stove where they done their cooking and like of that. And then there was a table down there that on hinges, it dropped. It was like a table, you drop it down, you know, and then you raise it up, then you put a stick under the end here for to hold it up.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that is big enough to seat three or four people.
Mm-hmm.
This table there, where we used to eat.
I heard once that corned beef and cabbage was the favorite food, is that right?
Oh, yes, and corned beef and cabbage, and then they called the old ham bone they used to cook up, you know, ham and cabbage. And then they had what they call the Irish stew, potatoes and onions and pork. All such stuff as that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We'd buy a ham down in Eddyville, and then, of course, we'd keep that on the boat, and as we want, if we want fried ham, we'd slice it off like that fried ham,
mm-hmm.
and we'd keep that, and that'd last us till we got up to Honesdale. To about, well, 4 or 5 days. See, the canal was 108 mile long and had 108 locks.
Hmm.
Of course, the locks weren't close together. There were some places. Now, you take up the Neversink Aqueduct, there were 6 locks there that was close together.
Mm-hmm.
And then up where the Delaware Aqueduct was, there were 6 more locks that was close together.
Mm-hmm.
Then down below here, at High Falls, down towards Kingston, there was a place there where there was 8 locks right close together.
Mm-hmm.
Go right out of one, putting it right into the other.
I guess people were kind of sorry when the canal season was over and they had to close up, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. You see, around here, all the, as we call them, canalers, we were all canalers. Of course, we always used to figure on our living off there. We used to buy our supplies, like up in Honesdale. We used to buy our potatoes there for 30 cents a bushel, and rutabagas, and big yellow turnips, buy them for 15 cents a bushel, and all stuff, cabbage, buy it for a cent a head, all stuff like that. That's the way the canals are. You get in their winter supply and bring it home here, wherever they lived along the canal. When we got, like my folks, they lived here. They got here, they'd take that stuff home and put it in the cellar,
mm-hmm.
keep it for the winter. And buy our butter. We used to get our butter up there, 15 cents a pound.
Hmm.
They used to pack it in 50-pound kegs, 50-pound into a keg. And what they call June butter. We always used to buy that up in Pennsylvania, up in Holmesdale.
And then about what time of year did the canal close up?
Well, of course, sometimes it's later. It's along in November when they'd freeze up. The canal would freeze up along in November sometime.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, before Christmas, along in November sometime. Sometimes right after Thanksgiving, that's about the time it closed. In the spring, it used to start up long from anywhere from the 1st of April to the 10th. That's when they'd start boating in the canal.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, when it come winter time, they'd draw all the water off the canal, so the canal was empty
mm-hmm.
all winter long.
Was there ever any trouble of people trying to race and get ahead of each other to the locks?
Oh, no, no.
Nothing like that.
Couldn't do that.
Couldn't do that.
No.
Uh-huh.
The canal wasn't wide enough. If you went to pass a boat, you couldn't pass it where it was regular, except where there was we call it a basin, a big wide space.
Mm-hmm.
Then if I got close to a boat and I wanted to pass them, and I had team strong enough that I could out-tow them, go faster, then that's wide water, I'd figure on passing them.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the way that used to go.
Uh-huh. Well, how could you pass them? You had a rope and they had a rope.
Well, we'd go right on past them.
Uh-huh.
And of course, when our mules got up to them, they'd have to take their team on the outside, and then we'd go right on our team that was passing this boat would go on the inside. On the towpath.
Uh-huh.
That's the way they pass a boat.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the light boats, there's a light boat and a loaded boat. Now, the light boat goes up, their team would take like the inside, see?
Mm-hmm.
And the loaded boat that come down, their team would be on the outside of the towpath. But then when they come to the light boat, the team would have to stop for the load boat so the light boat could go over the line would sink down in the canal.
You had traffic rules.
Oh, yes.
And If you disobeyed the rules, would they fine you?
No, there was never nothing like that.
I see. Uh-huh.
They never got in any trouble like that. No, I don't know what else I could tell you about.
You remember about your last trip on the canal?
Well, yes, I boated on the canal. I boated the coal. Let's see. In 1892, that's when I run my last coal boat. That is, the canal was open then, but I went to work then into the cement business, where they carried cement from Rosendale to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down then, and I worked there for, I worked in that, with that cement company for 9 years. I run a cement boat from there to New York. Well, I used to go all over around. I used to run over and over in the, up the Passaic River, over in the Wallabout Creek, over in Brooklyn, and up in West Farms and Westchester, and go all over those places.
Now, when you started from Rosendale, you had mules, right? Then when you got to the Hudson River, what did you do?
There was a, what they call, there was a man down at Eddyville. They used to have teams that would tow us. That when we was on these cement boats, we didn't have any teams, see? But when we got loaded cement on, ready to go down the canal, well, we telephoned to this man in Eddyville. Then he'd send a driver and a team up to tow us down. That was about 8 miles.
Mm-hmm.
8 miles, the end of the canal. He'd tow us down to Eddyville. Then we'd take and make up the tow. We'd go out to Kingston Point, where they made up the tow, then and tow down the river to New York.
Mm-hmm. Did they ever make up any jokes about the canalers or anything like that?
No, not to speak of.
You ever hear that rhyme, canalers, canalers, you'll never get rich?
As long as you die on the dirty old ditch. Yeah. Then they used to have signs. Used to be a fellow in Honedale. He used to have a sign on his feed box. He said, I'm the father of 21. Well, they all had different little names on the boat, you know.
Jokes?
They paint themselves.
Uh-huh.
I had on my cabin, like here, right along here, I had a painter put it on. He had a girl painted here and then had it onto it, the Ellenville Girl.
That was the name of your boat, huh?
But the name of the boat, of course, was not, they go by numbers.
I see.
Uh-huh. All the boats went by numbers. Mm-hmm. But when they put different little signs and sayings.
Uh-huh. So you put one on yours, too.
Sure.
You remember any of the other sayings on the boats?
I don't know. There's different ones. And let's see. Gosh, I don't know no more.
Mm-hmm.
Other names. There's a whole lot of them. Well, how are you children making out here? Pretty good?
Do you people have some questions you'd like to ask, Mr. Miller?
I wonder, what did you do in the winter time when you weren't working on the canal?
Well, of course, it's different people. They was home and different. But now, like here, this was a great place for to get wood up on this mountain, up near Sam's Point. Only we went off what they call a log cabin, only that side of Sam's Point. And there's people by the name of Cox Brothers that used to run a big wood yard down here. And, of course, we with our team, like my father and I, and all the canalers that boated, all maybe there's 15 or 20 of them right from Ellenville here. And then we used to draw cordwood in the wintertime. We'd get up 4 o'clock in the morning and go up that mountain. And our mules or horses, whichever we had, would be white with frost by the time they got to the top of the mountain. We'd be up there before daylight in the morning. And go where the wood was cut. The wood choppers up there, they got 75 cents a cord for cutting wood. and 4 foot length, and they'd pile it up in cord piled and half cord piled all over, and then we'd drive with our teams in there and get to these piles of wood and load up and get them and come down here to this wood yard to Cox's. Mm-hmm. Where they sell it.
Would the wood choppers stay up there all the time?
Oh yeah, they had what they call the log cabin. There was just a bunch of them up there, maybe 15 or 20 of them, and they had a man up there that done the cooking for them, and the rest of them went out and chopped wood mm-hmm. through the day.
Was there a hotel up there at Sam's Point at one time?
No hotel that I remember of.
Mm-hmm.
There was just boarding houses all through there. Mm-hmm. I don't ever remember of any hotel up that way. The nearest hotel was around Walker Valley. That's right the other side of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
But these wood choppers, they didn't care for any. They got their whiskey and they'd take their bottles up. They had plenty. They didn't want no hotel. Yeah.
Laurie?
How old were you when you first owned your boat?
How old were you when you first owned your boat?
16 years old.
When you owned your first boat?
Yeah. That's when I bought a boat. Cost me $425 that I paid for a boat and team. Had a boat and a pair of mules.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did your wife go canaling with you?
Oh, no. Well, I didn't get married until I was in the Smith business when I got married.
Uh-huh.
She made a few trips with me to New York.
Mm-hmm.
I lived down in Rosendale at that time.
I see.
I got married when I lived down there.
That is
in 96.
Mm-hmm.
1896. That's a good while ago.
Yes. There weren't many automobiles around then,
no,
were there?
No, no. Yeah, when I come back here, I guess I got some of the first automobiles around here. I had a 1910 automobile Ford car. That was the first thing I got right here.
Uh-huh.
I had a 1910. It had big straps on, big lights on to it, you know, big top. I used to go out riding. I was afraid the wind would blow us over. The big heavy top, you know, you'd pull it up. Strap it down.
You had to do a lot of cranking to get it started,
oh,
too.
Oh, my God. Knuckles used to be knocked off. They'd kick, you know. We used to crank. Then we had big lights on the side, big brass lights. And when they kick, you know, knock our hand over to get them light, knock and knuckles.
Well, at first, didn't you have to stop when you came to horse and buggy and lead the horse past?
What do you mean?
I mean, some horses would get frightened at the car, and you had to stop the car and lead them past.
Oh, that's time.
You had to do that, didn't you?
Yeah. I know, right here one time after I come back to Owensville, I went in the laundry business here. I was in the laundry business for 10 years, and I had a horse and wagon, where we used to deliver laundry around through the village and down as far as the instance, down in Nepponock and Cahonkson, up as far as Wettsburg. And that horse, once in a while, he'd never pay any attention to an automobile. Sometimes he'd get scared when an automobile would come, and he'd squat right down, and then he'd run. I know he'd run away with me down in Nepponock here. He cut my eye all open here. My driving lines got caught around my legs and threw me out of the wagon and drug me about 50 feet over the ground.
I guess you people don't realize what a runaway is like. That's quite something, wasn't it, when the horse would run away?
Yeah, the horse run away, and he went into a runaround, and he went into a stable, what they call where Shanley's Hotel is down here by the reformatory. He went into that stable, and there I go. And I had to go to a doctor there in Nepponock. I got my face all fixed up. I was all cut open here. I got my face fixed up.
All on account of an automobile, huh?
All the horse got afraid of an automobile. And just as he took streaks, sometimes he would pay no more attention than nothing, and other times he was scared right to death. Yeah.
When you were a young boy, young fellows
were pretty proud to own a nice horse and buggy, weren't they?
Oh, yeah. We didn't have no buggy, but I had my father and I, we had a nice horse and cutter here that we used to ride around in the winter. Big swell body cutters, you know.
A cutter is a little sleigh.
Yeah, a sleigh.
Decorated up,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah, we'd ride around all over. We used to go out, and as kids, young fellows, used to go out to dances, you know, and around different places, down to Kerhonkson, Nepponock, Wetsburg, Phillipsport, right all around.
Mm-hmm.
Up what they call the Drowned Lands, that's up to Ulster Heights, that's up that way.
Uh-huh.
We used to go all over to dances. And I used to play accordion. I used to be an accordion player, and I used to play to these, a lot of these dances. I'd go, and we'd go out sleigh loads in the wintertime, as young people.
Well, we're going to have a man play for us tonight at a square dance, George Van Cleek from Samsonville.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you play some of the same ones he did, like Sashay by Your Partner.
Yes.
The Lancers?
Yeah, the Lancers, you know, square dances, you know.
Uh-huh.
All kinds. Waltzes.
Uh-huh.
Schottisches.
Uh-huh.
I used to play all that stuff. That's years ago. When I run to New York, I was a great lad to pick up. If I'd hear, I'd go out to a theater summers, wherever I'd go, I'd pick up a song that they'd be singing in the theater,
mm-hmm.
and I'd come on my boat, and I'd take my accordion and I'd practice on that thing, and
mm-hmm.
play that tune.
Do you remember any of the songs, the names of any of the songs that were popular when you were a boy?
No. I used to go over, this Chassie Olcott used to be a great tenor singer. I used to go to hear him when I was over in Newark.
Uh-huh.
He used to play over there in the theater. Oh, gosh, I don't know songs anymore. I don't know.
I was just wondering if you'd remember any that were popular. Like today, they have a hit parade.
Yeah.
What were the songs in those days that they sang? Wasn't the Bowery the, that was the theater section?
Yeah,
the Bowery was the, like Broadway now.
Yeah. I used to go to 14th Street a whole lot. Used to go in there with the farmer. They had a play there one time where the oxen used to come right in on the stage with a load of hay. And all these farmers, they'd jump off of the hay load and they'd get to this old well. And they used to sing the old oaken bucket. And all stuff like that.
Do you remember the name of the theater?
It was on 14th Street. I forget which what theater it was now.
Our school is right around there. I just wondered whether the building was still there.
I was on 14th Street. Yes, sir.
Did you know a family by the name of Quick in Kahonkson?
Yes. There's different people.
Asa?
Yeah. I know different people by the name of Quick.
That Quick is an old family.
Yeah.
Well, I knew Asa Quick and his children, that's why I asked.
Uh-huh.
Oh, we got a couple families here in Ellenville named Quick.
There was a famous Tom Quick that they tell a story about, Tom Quick and the Indians. You ever hear that story?
Oh, I've heard it, yeah. These pictures, maybe these children want...
Oh, those are the... Yeah, we have some of those. Yeah, we got them at the library. Yeah, we're going to take them back with us. Yes, Louise? She wants to know what you ate besides corned beef and cabbage.
Well, anything. We used to, they used to be butchers. Used to run along the canal. There was butchers like from Hawley. They'd run down way along the canal. They'd come along, we'd buy a piece of meat of them, you know.
Would they have a stand or would they just drive along?
They had a horse and wagon.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd go along, a big covered wagon, you know, like a butcher wagon.
Mm-hmm.
Come along.
And
along the towpath?
Right on the towpath.
You see, there were lots of canal boats, so that was good business for them, wasn't it, to drive along there?
Yeah, there was different butchers along. And then most all the locks. There was stores most all over along the canal and different locks where you could buy anything you wanted.
Now,
you kept everything.
Now, take the canal traffic. On an ordinary day, in an hour, about how many boats would pass up and down, would you say, on the average?
Well, you take a loaded boat, run about 15 mile a day.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because you couldn't tell, you could figure out how many went by a lock in a day. And the light boat, they'd go about 20 mile a day,
mm-hmm.
maybe 25. Now, we used to start from here, from Ellenville, and we used to go up, let's see, 17 mile, 23 mile. That's what went to what they call the Never Sing Locks. That's the end of the 17 mile level.
That was a day's work.
That was a day's drive.
Mm-hmm.
Then when we come back, halfway over that 17 mile level, we was loaded then, coming down home. Then we'd figure on coming halfway, about 15 mile, come from there, we'd figure on getting home here overnight.
Oh, yes. You had a question, didn't you?
I was just, before when he was mentioning the meats, I was wondering about refrigeration, whether they had to eat it right away or...
What about the refrigeration? How did you keep the meat on the boat?
Well, you didn't want to keep it long, you wanted to eat it. You didn't want to keep it long. You didn't have nothing. Well, sometime, maybe you come along and you'd come to a place where the store to have an ice house,
mm-hmm.
where we could get a chunk of ice.
I see.
Of course, we knowed where all these places was, and where we figured on getting a chunk of ice and put it into a box and cover it up with blankets to keep, save it for 2 or 3 days, you know.
But that ice was stored from the winter time, or did you ice?
Yeah.
There was no ice making in those days, was there?
That was all stored.
That's something these children
were different places had ice houses.
They cut it up and put it away and kept it all through the summer. Did you people have some more questions?
I'd like to ask him if there was ever any, did you ever have any experience with a leak in the canal?
The what?
A leak in the canal and the water
runoff?
Oh,
yes.
And what did
we
you do
We used
then?
To call them breaks.
Oh, breaks.
Yeah. I asked many times, I know, down below here one time, down right near Nepenthe. They got a leak there, and then it washed out, maybe 15, 20 feet of the towpath. Washed it right away. And it's different places along the canal. I know it was up right the other side of Port Jervis one time, right where the Erie Railroad goes over, right below the railroad bridge. There was a break went out there one time, and we had to lay there for 2 weeks with the boat till they got this. Mm-hmm. Big place fixed up. Oh, they tore out maybe 100, 150 feet of the towpath. Took right out into the Delaware River.
Hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yes, there was often times there was leaks like that. But then, as I told you before, these scows, you know, the repairs,
yes.
They'd be coming along and they'd fix these places up.
Well, this has been awfully interesting. Very good.
Well,
we enjoyed hearing you.
I enjoyed telling you and what I know of it. I don't know. I don't know if there's anything more particular. Of course, it's all about the canal. Is all about the same routine
mm-hmm.
all the way through.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very, very much.
Well,
been very good.
You sure welcome.
Produces about 110,000 a year, which is larger than the whole of the West put together. I think there is not the faintest doubt that this country, which has a special local difficulty, that is the difficulty of earning enough money to feed itself, to live, must inevitably increase its number of skilled technological persons if it's to stand even a fighting chance.
Lord Russell, do you agree with that diagnosis?
I agree entirely with that. I don't think that this country can survive as a viable nation unless it enormously increases the production of scientists and technologists. I don't think there can be any doubt of that at all.
Well, shall we assume for the moment that this is the kind of change which is possible, that is to say that we could change the educational system and thereby change society, rather than have to await for a radical change in education, for a complete change in society. If we may assume that for a moment, and we can come back to whether it's a correct assumption, should we just ask ourselves, what kind of changes in education do you think this involves? Charles Snow, would you like to say?
Yes, well, that leads me to the second part of this problem, as I see it, that not only is it desirable in a utilitarian sense, it seems to me absolutely essential in a profound cultural sense that people should understand the world they're living in. Now, the world we're living in is to an immense extent determined and investigated by the principles of exact science. I mean, that has been the revolution of our time, which is a revolution of the last three centuries, a revolution as profound as the discovery of agriculture. Unless you know what the second law of thermodynamics means, you have no claim to consider yourself an educated person. Therefore, it seems to me, we have no hope in this deep spiritual sense unless we bridge the gap between the old literary culture, the culture of Latin grammar, the culture of words in the old-fashioned humanist sense, and the culture of this new investigatory technique which we call science. And that seems to me quite as important in the long term as the utilitarian point from which I started.
Well, it's very interesting to me to hear you say that, because this is so often presented, isn't it, as a purely material matter, that we must keep up with the Russians, that we must improve technology to live. But you begin by saying that those who don't understand the basic principles of science in the modern world are in fact barbarians. I mean, I think you're saying that.
Yes, I should say that.
What do you say?
I should agree to that. But there, of course, one got to make a distinction between theory and technology. I mean, theory has a cultural value in the old-fashioned sense. I don't know enough about technology, but I should doubt whether it had the same cultural value in the old-fashioned sense as theory has. Now, take, on the other hand, I think what is enormously important, that ways must be found of making teaching easier. Now, you spoke of the second law of thermodynamics. When one is told that entropy tends to a maximum, one feels rather puzzled. But if you're told you can't unscramble eggs, then you understand it.
Do you accept this distinction that Rust is making between basic and applied science?
Oh, absolutely. That seems to me the real clue and hope for the future. Yes. That in fact technology by itself tends to have a certain fixed, opaque, unspiritual quality, which we all dislike, even though a lot of the problems of technology, a lot of the problems of applied science, are at least as intellectually difficult as the problems of pure science. Nevertheless, it doesn't seem to me, and it doesn't seem in fact empirically to produce the kind of ethos that that pure science does. Therefore, I think if we have a foundation of pure science, which has its own values and its own spirit, that a lot of the probable vices of technology tend to be wiped away in the process.
So that everyone, as part of his general education, should have a good grounding in the basic principles of science. Is that putting it fairly?
That would certainly be my first, that would be my first suggestion. Now,
well, I have just a proviso there, that I think there's a good deal in the principles of science which many quite intelligent people are not capable of appreciating. And I think they should be let off if they are found to be really quite incapable of it.
Don't think it's good for their characters?
I think it produces an inferiority complex if you're in a society where that alone is value.
Are you thinking particularly of the mathematical?
Yes, mostly of that.
I wonder if I could just make a point there. You see, the educational world in this country, by and large, I think, adheres to the psychological theories which we associate with Spearman. That is the theory that if your intelligence is high, it is of general applicability. Therefore, if you are a person whose potential for doing Latin unseens or composition is high, your potential for doing mathematics is high. But the facts don't bear this out. Mm. And I have often argued that this shows that the way in which we teach mathematics must be wrong. Now, as an eminent mathematician, Lord Russell, what do you say to that?
I don't think it's true. I mean, undoubtedly you can do a great deal by teaching mathematics better. But I think it remains the fact that there are people whose minds naturally work in accordance with symbols, and others whose minds won't work that way.
Snow, do you accept this? I mean, would 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 you accept...
But I've no doubt whatsoever, as Lord Russell has said, that there are degrees of mathematical incompetence which do in fact disqualify people whom we should all regard as intelligent from understanding the physical universe in the way I've suggested. May I tell you my favourite story?
Please, sir.
A mathematician whom Lord Russell will know, E.W. Hobson, the Cambridge analyst, once told me of how he was trying to coach Wallace Budge, who finally, I ought to say, became the most eminent Egyptologist in the world. And he told me that I used to try and teach Wallace Budge how to get through Little Go, that is the Cambridge matriculation. And I used to say to Budge, if 2x equals 1, what does x equal? And Budge would think and turn his great wise eyes at me and say, minus 2. And I'm sure that is not unique. There are plenty of Budges in this world. And yes, I think going a bit further, there are still plenty. For instance, I think I was a fairly competent physicist, and I made one or two little contributions, and if I'd spent my life there, I'd have made some more. But I would never have achieved any sort of creative mathematics. I hadn't got that degree of mathematical insight. It would have made it possible. And I mean, Lord Russell must have met many such.
Well, of course, the stock example is Macaulay. Nobody would say that Macaulay was an unintelligent person.
Mm.
But he was totally incapable of mathematics. He couldn't see what it was.
What you're both saying is to me rather depressing, because if we're going greatly to increase the number of our young people and the proportion of our able young people, which you've told us is necessary, who study science rather than the humanities, we can't do it unless they can take a reasonable standard in mathematics. How do you account for the fact, Lord Russell, that this, for example, is done in Russia, where the proportion of young people studying science is many times greater than ours?
I don't know what they do about mathematics in Russia. I mean, I should want to be inside a Russian school to know what they do. Mm. At the same time, of course, I think they're capable of applying pressures that we can't apply.
Traditionally, of course, the Russians have placed a lot of value on semi-mathematical occupations like chess, which means that people with that kind of talent have been encouraged and applauded in all sorts of ways quite outside the ordinary utilitarian way.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether Lord Russell would agree with me, but I find it very hard to believe that one country has a serious statistical difference in the number of mathematical incompetence over another. What do you think of that?
No, I don't find that difficult.
Yeah, you.
I mean, after all, mathematics has been a product of Europe. And I don't see why other continents shouldn't have done just as good work if it was not congenital. After all, Indians started a great deal. They did very well to begin with. So did the Babylonians, so did the Egyptians.
Yep.
But they stopped.
Yes.
And I can't help thinking that is a congenital difference.
Well, supposing for the moment we leave mathematics and what we can or can't do about it, Snow, what else might we do in education? What about this business of the very early choice of arts or science and very intense specialization in school? Would you comment on that?
Well, I think I've made my views rather boringly public on that, but I am strongly against early specialization. I believe that with this specific difficulty of mathematics, and I should agree with Lord Russell that we ought to make it possible for people who are really mathematically incompetent to opt out, with that qualification, I should say that everyone up to 18 ought really to do a quite serious course in the exact sciences, that is, mathematics, physics, and chemistry, and in the literary subjects also. And I believe that is the only basic background upon which we can build a sort of serious, unified culture for this age.
Lord Russell, agree with that?
Yes, I should like to say a little about the cultural side of education. Under the influence of what I think is really kind of snobbery, it's been always held that you can't get the good of Greek and Latin civilization unless you know the Greek and Latin languages. Well, that may be true if you know them very well, but most of them don't. And if you ask any classical scholar, what about such and such a passage? Oh, that was mistranslated. They always tell you that. And so I think that we can get the good of the classical civilization in translations and save the time that we spend on learning Greek and Latin. And that altogether, if you're going to develop the cultural side of education alongside of the scientific side, you've got to admit ways of making it easy and rather quick.
Yes. Well, now, may I put two other...
May I put a word on that? Because I think this is most important. I passionately agree with all Lord Russell has said. I think that the idea that the humanities mean linguistics, which is part of the common assumption in this country, and to some extent throughout the West, is nonsense. I think it's very important to be said by Lord Russell, who, after all, whose philosophy has been the basic element in present-day linguistic theory, which is, in fact, the most dramatic development in philosophy in our age.
Well, I want just to put these two thoughts to you. Would you agree, first of all, that our idea of the proportion of young people who are capable of profiting by education, full-time education, after leaving school, is quite out of date? I mean, the proportion of the population going to universities in the United States is many times that of our own. It's true, of course, and it's often said, that our young people achieve a higher standard at their school leaving point and at the end of their first degree. But of course the Americans make up for this by prolonging the length of university courses and by having postgraduate schools. Do you see that as the kind of development for which we should be striving, Lord Russell?
Well, yes, I think you want postgraduate schools for a certain proportion of the population, not, I think, for the whole population.
No, no,
but for a
no.
certain proportion.
For a much greater proportion than at present.
A greater proportion than at present, because there are more things that need to be learned. But I don't know, I think it's not altogether easy to see how long a time people should spend on being trained before they get on to doing something. Because people get bored with being trained and trained and trained. And they make it like an athlete, they make it stale.
I believe almost the only advantage of the English system is that we actually get people to work rather earlier than anybody else in the world. We tend to get people into their first job at 21 plus rather than 23 or 4. Whereas nearly all continental, nearly all European countries, who educate a larger proportion of the population, spread their university education from 19 to 24. But I completely agree with you, Fisher, that in fact we educate a lamentably small part of the population. You go to a country which is industrialized to half our extent, like Italy, you'll find that in fact they're educating rather more people than we are.
Yeah.
And somewhere that can't be right. And it seems to me we're likely to be wrong rather than they, particularly when you see Italian graduates who are extremely good by any standards, and their average level seems to be in fact higher than ours.
Well, my impression is that we still think in universities particularly that the only legitimate form of university education is a high honours degree. I mean, would you think that the demands of modern scientific society demands something much, much wider than that.
I would certainly. I would think that both for practical reasons and also for social reasons, which is the one great advantage of American university education, a sort of social mixed-upness, that in fact you want to educate to a university level anyone who can get the standard of about the first year of a Cambridge degree course, or about half a Cambridge degree course, about 1.5 years, something like that.
This implies a great increase in our university population, Lord Russell, doesn't it? I mean,
obviously that ought to be. But I should like to say just a few words more about making the cultural aspects of education easier than they are now. Now, I believe very much, very strongly, that a man ought to have some picture of history in his mind, of the way the human race has developed and the problems it's been faced with.
Yes.
And I think that can all be done very much more easily than it is at present if you eliminate the pedantic elements and don't expect people, for instance, to read diplomatic medieval charters, things like that. The training of professionals, narrow professionals, it's not the thing that gives culture.
I couldn't agree again more strongly. I mean, for the real difficulty about scientists, it seems to me that the whole nature of the profession means that they're taught to think about one thing obsessively for a long time. And that is what scientific skill and eminence depends upon. The corrective of that seems to me to be something like social history, where you have to think about a lot of things, not in depth and not obsessively, but at once.
Yes.
And that is why I should like to see social history taught almost as a compulsory subject to anybody who is going to have any position in the world.
One of the problems that which exercised us a great deal in education in thinking about this was finding ways to make things other than scientific matters interesting to the typical English scientifically minded schoolboy. After all, you can always arrange that a boy can pass an examination in Shakespeare and philosophy, but that is worthless unless it means something to him. And that's really one of the great problems. Lord Russell suggests social history with particular reference to its scientific applications, perhaps, or the applications.
Well, I hadn't thought of that. No, I'd thought of it as rather a corrective to purely scientific education.
But you do see my point.
I mean, do see your point.
Having been a sixth form master, you see, trying to teach science boys who are going to take science scholarships to write a passable essay for their general paper. It's awfully difficult to make them interested. I suppose that, in the end, will only be solved if we can have really inspired teachers. And I wonder if you would say what you think about that problem. It's much worse, I believe, in America than here, the shortage of well-qualified science teachers, isn't it, Sir Charles?
It's very difficult in both countries. I think in most, America, remember, is a big country and states differ. I mean, the New York state, for instance, is just beginning to pay science teachers very handsomely, but over most of the United States you'll find very good schools, which we should call grammar schools, good state high schools, where they have no science teacher of any kind whatsoever. And here, of course, we're in a predicament which is similar, but they're not quite so grave. Then I'm sure we've got to, by whatever means, to increase the prestige, the pay, of the teaching profession in order to make people want to teach science.
How do they do that in Russia? I mean, how do they?
Oh, very simple. Well, partly very simply. I mean, by paying a science teacher about the same amount as they pay a deputy manager of a factory. That is, in English terms, about 3,000 a year, which is substantial. But also, and I think this is much more important, by really giving teachers a sort of prestige that they've never had here. But if you read Russian novels at the moment, you'll find the teacher in a small Russian village is the wise man of the community. He's rather like the priest in a sort of novel about rural Italy, for instance. I mean, he's looked up to, he's doing something, and he's proud of his job. Now, that we haven't done, and that, it seems to me, we must do. Mm.
But you know, this takes us back to a question we touched on earlier. We talk about the manipulating the educational system to produce radical changes to meet the needs of our new situation in industry. And one of the things we've come to now is building up the prestige of teachers. But I wonder whether the culture, the tradition of a civilization, you see, is not so fundamental to a society that you can't change it in that way without a revolution. Lord Russell, I'm sure you've thought much about this.
I think you can, yes. I mean, after all, America has changed very considerably without a revolution. At least there's no revolution since 1776. And I think you can do it without a revolution, though not, of course, with the same thoroughness as they've done it in Russia, where they've had a revolution. It will be a little more piecemeal and a little less adequate from the systematic point of view, but I'm not sure that it's any the worse for that. I'm not a great lover of systems.
No.
I'm sure it can be done, can't it? I should have thought what's happened in China is proof of that. But can it be done within a democratic society by discussion and agreement, Snow, do you think?
I hope it can, and I think it's possible that it can. I was thinking of the Japanese after they were erupted into by Europeans about 1860, that in fact, under the Meiji regime, they did astonishingly alter their educational pattern and a great deal of the rest of their pattern, and still kept the traditional roots of Japan rather surprisingly intact.
Mm. Can I just ask you to look at one which I'm afraid must be the last point? You know, it's often argued when one discusses this with headmasters of grammar schools, for example, it's argued that let all these changes come to pass, something very valuable will be lost, because an education based on science cannot be as effective in preserving and developing the values of our society, our civilization, the traditions of our civilization as they've grown up in the past. Am I making the point reasonably clearly?
Yes, I think that's true, but then I think one can't have everything. Now, undoubtedly, in Elizabethan times, there were many more people than there are now who could write verses. You remember that in Cymbeline, there's a fellow who is so barbaric that he can't really produce a good poem, and he has to hire a penny a liner, a most inferior fellow who produces Hark, Hark the Lark. And there is something lost. We can't reach that point in production of poetry, but after all, it's worth it.
Let me put it to you in another way. It's sometimes said, you see, that the more you develop technology, the greater proportion of people you need in society who are concerned with management, with supervision, with organization, with technical skills. Now, the best kind of education for training people to manage other people, to develop systems of human cooperation, the best kind is training in the humanities. Now, what do you say about that?
I'm afraid I think that's nonsense.
I think it's absolute rubbish.
Yes. Do say why, if you will. Would you?
Well, I would have thought it depends entirely upon temperament, and that temperament isn't affected by the particular intellectual discipline a man goes through. That you get superb managers who've been engineers from their youth up, and you get some good ones, though not in highly technical industries, because the actual intellectual difference is too great, who've been trained in the humanities. But the kind of human skills, the kind of human insights that people possess seem to me to be far more innate than what you're given by that sort of process.
Lord Russell, would you like to
conclude? Well, yes, I come back to it that there is undoubtedly an element of loss in giving up the sort of emphasis on the cultural side of education, but I don't think the loss need be very great, and I think it's absolutely far outweighed by the gain. I mean, to understand the world in which we live is, after all, very important indeed. And is, you might say, one of the main aims of human life. Mm. And you can't begin to understand the world without science.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what emerges to me, and this may be just my own personal prejudice, but what emerges to me very clearly is, again, the very fundamental need for a radical change in our education in this country as a matter of survival. And beyond that, I only want just to say in conclusion to you both, thank you very much indeed for the most interesting half hour which you've given to me, and I hope to others also. Thank you very much.
Bertrand Russell and C.P. Snow were the speakers in that discussion, and the chairman was Norman Fisher. The program was recorded by the BBC.
Stand against hysteria, against McCarthyism, and for unity among peoples, Negro and white, city and country, old people of old American backgrounds against newcomers. This camp that thrived, prospered in its ideals, that put its roots deeply into the Catskill earth, this camp that survived the onslaught of McCarthyite committees, now is threatened by the very people who helped to found it.